You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 21st, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, I'm still sick. Also joining us, Ari Berman from The Nation. Amanda Marcotte from Freelance Journalist, writes for Pentagon and Slate. Has a podcast at RH Reality Check. Today we will discuss the ongoing battle to make sure that literally hundreds of thousands of people across the country are not purposefully prevented from voting. Eligible voters. And, I mean, folks, could we really not address just how bat crap crazy the Republicans have become? I know. We don't want it to have a horse race, blah, blah, blah. But actually, you know, this guy Aiken really did pull the lid off this. They cannot help themselves. And then the other unfortunate part is that we now seem to have, in the last 48 hours, added the term forcible rape to our lexicon. Now we're all supposed to know the different types of rape. I guess presumably because that helps us make policy. I'm not sure exactly why. Also on the program today, stunning revelations came out in a lawsuit about the NYPD spying program. We've spoken about that in the past. This was the ongoing program that was coordinated with the CIA in New York City. Play that 911 tape when a superintendent in New Jersey found like a stakeout. Just amazing, the revelations about this spying outfit. And guess who got universal health care? Was it Britain? No, they already had it. Sweden? No, they already had it. Finland, France, Italy, Belgium, Switzerland, Denmark. Nope, they already had it. Canada? No, are you kidding? They've had it for a long time. Whoa, where could it be, Sam? Bermuda? No, I imagine they have it too. Mexico! That's right. Mexico. Despite the fact that we constantly hear that all it is now is a narco state, which actually probably may be somewhat true, at least they are providing healthcare for their entire population. Apparently, that's just too tough a road to hoe in this country. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Ari Berman. I'm putting you folks on warning, notice today. Today's going to be a short show. I know I said that yesterday and then ended up doing a half hour extra beyond what we normally do. That was a mistake. But today, it really is going to be a short show. I vow it. I've been poisoned by my daughter. She gave me a virus that has made me horribly ill. Breathing on me. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, Ari Berman, by the telephone, so that I do not in some way poison him. We'll be right back after this. All right, we are back on the phone from The Nation magazine. Ari Berman, who tells me that are you on the lam? What I understand? What's going on?
I may be one of those, soon be one of those felons, Sam, who can't vote because I moved and I went to my old apartment and I saw that I had a jury duty summons for July 16th, which obviously has passed. So do you have any legal advice you can give me pro bono?
Yeah, I would leave the country as soon as possible before they put an APB out on you. That's what I would do. That would be the first thing I would do. No, I would call them.
I was going to see if the new Black Panther Party could bail me out.
Right. I mean, let me contact my peeps in the reconstituted Acorn. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe the reconstituted Acorn could fake my identity and get me out of jury duty.
Right. We know that Acorn, the reconstituted Acorn, is basically on the fringes of just about 10 miles outside of the outer boroughs of New York City, just waiting for me to give the signal, and then they descend upon the city.
It's a sleeper cell. It's a sleeper cell waiting to steal the election for Obama again.
I think if you call them and you tell them what happened, they'll be okay with it. But you're going to have to serve, Ari. I mean,
I know. Well, I'm prepared to serve, Sam.
I got news for you. You're not going to get selected.
I know. I mean, I would like to get selected, but you know, all these radical beliefs we share may disqualify me.
Right. I never got selected in New York City. I did get selected up in Hudson.
Yeah. Well, in Hudson, anything goes.
Right.
Yeah. Anything goes in Hudson.
I did a DWI up in Hudson, a case, but down in
it wasn't your DWI.
No, I sat on the jury.
Oh yeah.
But I did I practiced coming in drunk.
You didn't have a strong ideological opinion on drinking as opposed to other subjects?
You know, they didn't ask me any questions that would... I mean, no, I didn't. I mean, I, you know...
What did they ask you in New York that disqualified you?
What do you do?
Yeah.
That took me out of the race.
That must have been a long answer. I mean, what did you even tell them?
Yeah, well, I mean, who knows at the time. I think it was probably video games and... a couple other things. But, I mean, as soon as you say I'm a writer for The Nation magazine, the prosecutor's going to go like, okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your he'll ask you a question or two or she will ask you a question or two to be friendly about it. Like, how's that? Oh, that sounds like fun. All right, well, thank you. And then because he's got to seem friendly because, you know, he still has the other jurors there that he's got to appeal to.
But yeah.
Then you're done. So, And you know, the best time to serve is actually August.
Yeah, because already August 20th. So.
Right. No, you're in trouble. But speaking of in trouble, we know that if you do become convicted as a felon and you serve your time in many states around the country, by the fiat of the governor, that happened in Florida, you will not be able to vote.
Yeah.
Will you explain
Florida, Florida and Iowa are the two states since the 2010 election that have, by executive order, change their laws to prevent ex-felons from voting.
Now, I want to, this audience is pretty up to date on what's going on with a lot of this, but I want to broaden out, and then I want to talk about Pennsylvania and Ohio in particular. But will you please explain to people, there is no constitutional right to vote in this country, is there?
No, I mean, it's a little bit complicated in that there have been a lot of different amendments passed to the Constitution that deal with the right to vote, but there is no explicit guarantee to the right to vote in the U.S. Constitution, and that is a problem because when you have the U.S. Supreme Court, for example, saying to states you can pass voter ID laws even if you present no evidence of voter fraud, that would be somehow stopped by a voter ID law, that sets a very bad precedent. And so we're seeing that.
In what case was that? What case was that? Judge Stevens.
That was the Crawford versus Marion, Indiana case relating to a voter ID law passed in Indiana in 2005 and upheld by the Supreme Court in 2008. And what the plaintiffs who challenged that law in Indiana said is they said that people would be disenfranchised by the law, and the law was unnecessary because there was no evidence of voter fraud in Indiana to justify the law. And Indiana said, yes, there is no voter fraud in the state, but we can still pass this law. And the Supreme Court basically signed off on that. And so that sets a very bad precedent for challenging voter ID laws in many, many states.
It's very difficult. And indeed, we had a big ruling in Pennsylvania. Tell us about that ruling, first off, and if it was a surprise. I was surprised by it.
I was surprised by it. I mean, there's kind of two different ways that judges can go about ruling on these cases. I mean, if you look at states like Wisconsin and Missouri, judges there did block voter ID laws in those two states because they said they violated the right to vote provision in the state constitution. The Pennsylvania constitution is very similar to the Missouri constitution, so there was many grounds on which it seemed like the judge could have at least enjoined the law. Instead of looking at the state constitution, the judge seemed to look to the U.S. Supreme Court instead for his guidance. And I think that was a decision the judge made that he didn't necessarily have to do. But once he looked to the U.S. Supreme Court, it was pretty clear he was going to uphold the law based on the existing precedent. I think it was a bad ruling. I think the judge made a lot of assumptions about the state that are incorrect. He said that the law was going to be implemented in a nonpartisan, even-handed manner, which is absolutely shocking when you have Pennsylvania Republicans saying the purpose of the law is to elect Mitt Romney, when you have Pennsylvania Republicans overwhelmingly passing this law over Democratic objections, when you have a situation where Pennsylvania has only provided money for a tenth of the IDs needed in the state. I mean, they've only allocated money for 75,000 IDs, even though, according to the Department of Transportation, 750,000 voters don't have voter ID. So, I mean, the state's totally unprepared to implement the law. It's incredibly partisan. It's not well thought out. And it's not needed. But the judge said, oh, let's just forget all that. The state can do what it wants.
Now, from there, it goes to the state Supreme Court. Is that right? Or
yeah, now it goes to the state Supreme Court.
And is the argument the same, or will there be a different tact in terms of, like, for instance, it seems to me that there is an opportunity here to claim that, okay, the legislature has the right to pass this law. The law does not inhibit the right under the Constitution of Pennsylvania to provide a vote. But couldn't they also say, like, well, we want to enjoin it just because it's not – they are not able to execute this law in time. In other words,
so I think that you could just argue it on a practical level. It's interesting if you look at what the judge said in Pennsylvania, and this was another puzzling assertion. He said that it would be more difficult for Pennsylvania to abandon the law than to go ahead and implement it.
That's
shocking to me. That's absurd, because Pennsylvania's never had a voter ID law. So if they abandon this law, they would run the election like every other election in Pennsylvania, the 2010 election, the 2008 election, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, none of which were questioned for their legitimacy. Now they have to implement this.
How did that judge justify that statement? I mean, under what?
He justified the statement by essentially quoting testimony from an official for the state of Pennsylvania who said that it would be difficult for them to suspend the law right now because they already sent materials out to election officials. But that's just such an absurd absurd. It's such an absurd allegation because, like I said, Pennsylvania is totally unprepared to implement this law. They have only printed a tenth of the IDs needed. You look at the DMVs in Pennsylvania. Nine counties don't even have a DMV office in Pennsylvania. In 13 other counties, the office is open one day a week. We're talking about 758,000 voters, according to the Department of Transportation, registered voters who don't have correct voter ID. Now they have to all get IDs, every single one of them, in the span of 2.5 months from a state that is completely unprepared to implement the law. So you're telling me it's easier to keep that law in the books than to run the election like it was run in every other election? I mean, it was really an absurd and puzzling statement. And from a judge that had a relatively fair-minded reception, I mean, it really just seemed like he was reciting right-wing talking points when it came to this ruling.
Now, not to get crass here, but to try and determine how much impact this is going to have, when you talk about those nine counties that don't have a DMV, when you talk about those other counties which, you know, the DMV is open once a week or whatever it is. Where are these counties located? What are the what's the partisan index there? I'm just curious as to.
Yeah.
I mean, because I would imagine, like, look, you've got 750,000 people who are ostensibly caught in this sort of web of people who have either expired ID driver's licenses or IDs that don't have an issuance date or an expiration date, like, you know, college students.
Yeah.
You've got 43 or 48% of the people in Philadelphia that don't have this. So this comes down to how many of those old people in the rural areas that are Republican strongholds will be disenfranchised relative to, you know, urban centers where you have a higher African-American population or higher student population. Give me a sense. I mean, do you have a sense of that?
I have a little bit of a sense of it. I mean, I'll honestly have a better sense of it next month because I'm going to Pennsylvania to do more reporting.
Right, and when you're in prison, you'll also have a lot of time to think about that. Right.
Yeah, exactly, and I'll have a lot of time to make calls from prison. So just to answer the first part of the question, 9% of registered voters, according to the state of Pennsylvania, don't have the correct voter ID. But that number is 18% in Philadelphia, which is a city that is 44% African American. So I think we can reasonably infer from that data that a lot of the problem is in Philadelphia among African American voters. And I think there is now a voter ID coalition dedicated to trying to get people IDs, even though that should be the role of the state, but the state has been completely incompetent in implementing this law. Or maybe they haven't been incompetent. Maybe the point of the law is to not actually get people IDs, to make it harder for them to vote, which is what I suspect. But in any case, that voter ID coalition has been focused on Philadelphia. And I was on a panel with Heather Smith, the president of Rock the Vote, and she told a story. She was in talking to high school seniors in inner city Philadelphia, and she asked them, how many of you have a driver's license or a state-issued Pennsylvania ID? And she said one person in the class raised their hand.
Wow.
Now, granted, that is an anecdotal story, but I think it's fair to assume that there's a major problem in Philadelphia making sure everyone has the IDs. That said,
now hold on. Let me just make one point here, that the way Democratic candidates, not just President Obama, but Democratic candidates win Pennsylvania is usually by winning so big in the urban centers, in Philly in particular, that it overcomes the deficit for the rest of the state.
And you don't think that the Pennsylvania Republicans knew that when they passed this law?
Did.
I mean, the whole point of passing this law is to suppress the Democratic vote in Philly. That is the entire goal. That said, I'm not totally sure that Republicans have completely thought this through because there was just a new study out, and it found that if you look at the 13 southeastern counties in Pennsylvania, and this.
The cops have already come and got you. Are you there? All right, we'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry, Ari, we lost you for a second.
So I was just going to say...
They haven't thought this through.
Well, I think there's a chance that a number of Republican-leaning seniors could be disenfranchised by this law, because there is a new story out in the morning call that says that in the Lehigh Valley, seniors are 21% of registered voters, but 33% of them don't have state-issued photo ID. Now, you can vote in Pennsylvania at an exception so that you can vote with a nursing home ID, if that's the case. But I do think that there's a decent chance that there could be a lot of senior citizens who also could be disenfranchised with this law, as well as younger voters and minority voters. But I do think that the law is structured in such a way that it's going to disproportionately affect African-American voters in particular. In
Philadelphia. Right. I mean, they knew this. I mean, they knew, like, okay, we'll have some of our voters will be disenfranchised, but, you know, we're going to have more of theirs, and that's the way that we do this, right? I mean, that's the game. Now, in Ohio, you know, I'll tell you something. The idea that we even be talking about Ohio at this point, I mean, how many elections do we have to go through this BS? This is just unbelievable. It's just
Ohio and Florida. I mean, Ohio and Florida, it's amazing that we are talking about making it harder to vote in both of these states, given what happened in Florida in 2000 and what happened in Ohio in 2004. And, I mean, it's the same kind of things. I mean, it was the same kind of thing in Florida with voter purges and people wrongly being told they were felons and not being able to vote. You fast forward again in Florida, there's another major inaccurate voter purge underway. Felons can't vote once again. You look at Ohio. Ohio had extremely long lines in 2004. Early voting emerged as a bipartisan reform in Ohio to make it easier to vote and avoid those long lines, particularly in the most populous urban areas. That worked very well in 2008, too well for the Democrats, because the Republicans said, no, we don't want this same amount of early voting anywhere, because it's going to benefit Democratic candidates and President Obama, particularly in the most populous urban areas that are heavily African-American and also have a lot of young people. And so Ohio has drastically cut back early voting for no other reason than it was something that Democrats used effectively in 2008.
What is it going to take? I mean, what is it going to take for, at what point do the Democrats, I mean, I guess it's never going to happen, right? The Democrats are never going to get into office and say, we need to have some type of universal right to vote. You know, they have the Help of America Vote Act, accounting, whatever it was, HVA, I don't know what it was, the HAVA Act. And it seems to me that, like, their attitude is, demographically we'll overcome this, we don't want to expend any political capital on this. But I mean, how much political capital would it take to secure the vote? I just don't understand.
Well, I mean, I think the attitudes on this are changing, because I think that Democrats increasingly realize that they can't take the right to vote for granted, and that they have to be as aggressive in expanding the right to vote as Republicans are at trying to block it right now. And so I do think there is a changing perspective on this. There was a piece of legislation introduced in the House by House Democrats called the Voter Empowerment Act that I thought was a very good piece of legislation. I think where there are Democratic legislatures and where there are Democratic governors now, they absolutely have to make it easier for people to vote. That's really the only long-term way to combat these laws, because right now it's true that Democrats are in a totally defensive position. They're in a better defensive position now than they were a year ago. That's absolutely true. There's been a lot more public attention. A lot more of these laws have been blocked. In places like Ohio, there's been an incredible amount of pushback to what the Republicans are doing. That just didn't happen a year ago. So, I mean, I think there are some signs of progress, but I also think that you have to look broader. You have to look, for example, at the courts. We've talked about this before, Sam. It's incredibly important to get progressive judges on the local courts, on the federal courts, and on the Supreme Court, so they don't issue these type of rulings that we saw in Pennsylvania, or even that we saw from the Supreme Court in 2008. And so I think progressives need to think about this in many different ways, not just from a legislative perspective, but also from an executive perspective and a judicial perspective, in terms of expanding the right to vote.
Well, I mean, if President Obama wins this election, he's got to come out. I mean, he's got to sort of expend the capital that he has, that he's not running for election again. And I mean,
it's amazing that Obama hasn't expended any political capital when he's been in office to try to get judges on the courts. I mean, that's one of the most lasting things that he could do. that's one of the most lasting things any president can do. And as we just saw in a recent New York Times article, they've completely dropped the ball on this. So I certainly do hope that this is something that the president does in a second term. But you just have to wonder, why is he waiting for a second term to do this? I mean, there's not really much he has to risk by trying to get his judges on the court. It's not like the American people would be outraged that he's trying to appoint his judges. I think quite the opposite, that people are outraged at the basic functions of the government, which includes appointing judges, just isn't happening right now.
Bill Ayers told him to wait. That's why he's doing it. Bill Ayers and Acorn told him to wait.
Obviously. I mean, that's who he takes his marching orders from.
Course.
I mean, he has since 1975.
We know that, of course. I mean, that was part of the whole... That was a whole part of the Manchurian thing. You don't start the whole full socialist takeover until the second term. Everybody knows that, Ari.
He'll have more flexibility then. That's what he told Medvedev. So.
Right. Yes, we know. That's when we're going to become a client state of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, so, that's when the socialist takeover begins.
Well, hopefully they'll do something about it. I mean, because there's obviously two issues here. One is that to spend resources on making sure that people can vote undercuts the ability to elect good people to office. And then the other thing is that theoretically we live in a democracy, and this is probably even more important, aside from any type of partisan concerns, we shouldn't be actively disenfranchising people.
You look at a situation like Ohio, where Democratic commissioners in Montgomery County, Ohio, which includes Dayton, they voted for early voting. They were told by the Ohio Secretary of State, rescind your vote or you will be suspended. They refused to rescind their votes, and they were suspended from the Board of Elections for advocating early voting. Not a socialist takeover of the country, Sam. Early voting. I mean, it's unbelievable what it's come down to, that we're actually arguing about early voting. I sometimes just can't even believe the things that I've been covering for a year. It's so stupid and idiotic that we're having these fights in the year 2012. But I mean, there's nothing else you can do but just follow them and be in a defensive posture and try to roll back, try to stop this incredible rollback.
Tell me about stupid and pathetic. We're going to say goodbye to you now, and we're going to talk to Amanda Marcotte about this whole concept of different tiers of rape and who should be allowed to have an abortion, because if they've been raped enough.
It's really great the level of sophistication in American politics these days, particularly from our conservative friends.
Well, see if when they send you to jail for your scofflying over the jury, see if you can get extraordinarily rendered to a different country, and then let me know how it works out there.
Sure. Yeah, I will. I'll send you a postcard from Grenada.
All right. I appreciate it. Ari Berman, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much, Ari.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Amanda Marcotte, freelance journalist, Pentagon, Slate. She's got a podcast at RH Reality Check. I'm not exactly sure what address that is. I don't know how you get that, but we'll be right back after this. We are back on the Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Amanda Marcotte, freelance journalist who writes for Pentagon and Slate's XX Factor, and also is a co-host of a podcast at RH Reality Check. What is RH Reality Check? Where do, I don't understand. Where is there a website for that or what?
Yeah, RH Reality Check is a reproductive rights online magazine that I write for and I podcast for.
Great. And go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, we're the largest on the internet.
Oh, all right. Well, that's impressive. All right, I love it. Reality check. Realitycheck.com. No.
RHrealitycheck.org.
Okay, and I got to warn you right now. I have a horrible cold, so if I sound less than my sort of quick and charming self, it's because I'm very, very sick. I'm like literally sitting here in a pool of my own sweat.
Oof, I'm sorry.
Yeah. But that aside, maybe not the best way to start off an interview, Amanda, but, you know, different strokes for different folks. This is just completely crazy. Let me just play the ad that Todd Akin now has come out with. We have really, it seems to me, just sort of gone through the looking glass, but the fact is probably different. So here's the ad.
I'm Todd Akin, and I approve this message. Rape is an evil act. I used the wrong words in the wrong way, and for that I apologize. As the father of two daughters, I want tough justice for predators. I have a compassionate heart for the victims of sexual assault, and I pray for them. The fact is, rape can lead to pregnancy. The truth is, rape has many victims. The mistake I made was in the words I said, not in the heart I hold. I ask for your forgiveness.
Now, Amanda, he's lying there, isn't he? When he says, like, you know, the mistake is in the words that I said, and I used the wrong words in a wrong way. And the fact of the matter is that there's nothing he said that he doesn't still believe in. He didn't misspeak. He just maybe was just slightly inarticulate. But he's expressing a belief system, isn't he?
Yeah, he used complete sentences, a number of complete sentences. I really don't think there's a way to say I accidentally used the wrong word to express the belief that if a rape is legitimate, or he went on Huckabee's show and said forcible, that's the only kind of, that those kinds of rapes will somehow never result in pregnancy. He's trying to minimize this, but I'm not seeing him actually back off and explain. He's just not really taking it back. He's just sort of pretending he never said it.
Right. And the fact is that when we look at the bill that he co-sponsored with Ryan, they want to slice up essentially the different types of rape. You know, honestly, like, I'm trying to sort of like take this at face value without sort of a judgment at first, because I think what they're suggesting is even far worse than what he said, frankly. The idea being that there is statutory rape, where, like, I guess theoretically, you know, a 17-year-old boy and is dating and has sex with a 15-year-old girl, and the age of consent is 16 in the state or something like that. That, I guess, presumably is not forcible rape. But it seems to me that what they are doing is basically saying that, like, if you have sex on your own accord, you're going to get punished with it by having the baby.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most generous reading of it. I think that, you know, that they're trying to, like, get so-called statutory rapes out. So it is worth pointing out that a lot of the time a forcible rape is prosecuted as a statutory rape because it's easier to get a guilty verdict with that. So, I mean, that's part of the problem. But I also, it's worth noting that the legal system doesn't really have a term for forcible rape. That's a really vague term. So putting forcible, like redefining the Hyde Amendment so there's only exceptions for forcible rape, would have created this situation where it's quite possible that any rape where the rapist didn't actually beat you down would not be covered.
Right, if you didn't fight back hard enough or something. But I mean, try and get inside these creepy minds for a moment. Like, you know, what is there has to be some type of subtext to this. That is, you know, it seems to me, is this sort of like, this is, this does not, I mean, the idea that they're all on the same page and that they're all talking about forcible rape, it seems to me there's a subtext here that in some way by making these distinctions, it either takes them further towards their goal or it sort of in some way manifests some other belief system.
Yeah, I wrote a piece at Salon where I kind of talked about there's a lot of different connections here. I think that it's what's driving Paul Ryan, what's driving Todd Akin, and what's driving a lot of the people that are interested in making these distinctions is that they sincerely believe that many, probably most rape accusations, most rape claims are women who are lying about what happened to them. I think a lot of them think that they think women having sex is shameful. So in their mind, they believe that women frequently have consensual sex and then the next morning wake up and call the cops to sort of cover up the shame of having sex, which is a myth that's really widespread and falls apart if you think about it for a second. Cause you know, if you had some regrettable sex, like I really doubt that the best thing for you would be to get involved in a long, drawn-out prosecution over it.
Right.
But I think that that's part of what's going on here is that they really, you know, we can't separate anti-abortion people and their ideas about women and abortion from a whole galaxy of ugly attitudes towards women.
Well, I guess that's what I'm getting at here is that, and I think it's like it's very hard for maybe it's unfair for me to say normal people, but it's very hard for normal people to sort of understand that, I think, that the idea that there's a distinction between rapes or that the idea that that women would go through that process because of the intense shame that they have because of having sex sounds so ludicrous to us, but that it really is a reflection of their worldview. Like, I mean, I think deep in his heart, Todd Akin really believes this stuff. Like, you know, they, if they've really been raped, they don't get pregnant. I really do think he believes it. I mean, I think he's that bat crap crazy that if they've really been raped, that they don't get pregnant because the, because pheromones are set off and keep the egg from implanting or whatever it is in their quackadoodle science, that he really believes this. And so this makes sense on some level if you have those notions that rape, when someone charges rape and they're pregnant, they're lying. Almost definitionally speaking, they're lying. They didn't really, they just feel guilty about having sex.
Yeah, I mean, what it is really that they use all these scientific sounding terms, but really what it is magic. You know, it's also important to remember that the anti-choice movement is fundamentally a religious movement. They're religious fundamentalists that believe that God performs miracles on a daily basis, that he answers prayers, that there's angels everywhere, that we live in a demon-haunted world. And that's where this is coming from. If a woman is so-called legitimately raped, they think, well, God will definitely intercede and not make her pregnant.
Ah, I see. Okay. So, And that's how you can tell. I mean, that's where this whole concept of like, if she floats, she's a witch type of thing, right? I mean, God will step in if there's a real rape. And so pregnancy is proof that it's not a real rape.
Yeah. And I mean, they know better than to say that in religious terms to reporters and journalists. So instead, they try to frame it in these pseudoscientific language that they think is more socially acceptable, and then they just end up sounding like morons. You know, it would probably sound more coherent if someone like Todd Akin just talked about God and Jesus, which is what's going on in the hamster wheel behind, you know, his mouth.
Right. And so how do you explain Mike Huckabee coming out in his sort of as part of Todd Akin's shame me tour and so I can have redemption tomorrow tour. How do you reconcile Huckabee saying there's been some extraordinary people who are product of rape?
Well, it's funny to me because it's like, it's interesting because, yeah, those beliefs sound like they're contradictions, but I think there's just, they just have this, they're not thinking in logical, straightforward ways. They're thinking in this sort of bundle of magical thinking and this sort of belief in God will grant blessings and that babies are always blessings. And I also think, you know, there's this sort of general notion, how else to put this? I think they're also forgetting that they're kind of working under the notion that a lot of rape victims were, you know, quote unquote, asking for it, you know? So I think that's like a little bit of what's going on here is that these illegitimate rapes are maybe rapes, but she was wearing a short skirt, so she got pregnant. It's a very weird mishmash of beliefs, but it all comes from like one underlying coherent belief, which is that there's a God in heaven who's going to make sure that that it always works out the way it was supposed to. And I think that's like, even when they say different things that contradict each other, it always comes back to this notion that their God will make it right. If you were not going to get pregnant, if you were really a victim, or if you did get pregnant, then you had it coming, or if you were really a victim and you got pregnant, it's going to still be good for you because you're going to love that baby. Or they have different ways of spinning this, but it always comes back to this notion that we certainly don't need legal abortion is the other thing that they always circle back to.
Right, despite the fact that they don't really sort of have a notion of how to deal with illegal abortions. I mean, there's, I think Digby posted the other day that sort of great video of somebody asking all these anti-choice people, okay, so abortion's illegal. What do you do with a woman if she has an abortion? What's the legal punishment? And they all basically said, well, you know, we've got to pray for her. Well, you know, like nobody even says like a ticket. It's just like we've got to pray for her. I mean, it's really just more of a declaration that they want, right? And then of course you can also punish the doctors, I guess, but not the women.
Yeah, the so-called doctors. What's kind of lost in all that? It's funny because it's not like we don't know what happens when the abortion is banned. It used to be banned in this country.
Right.
We can just sort of look at what happened when it was banned and sort of get a general idea of what happened. And yeah, there were doctors who performed illegal abortions, and sometimes they did go to jail. But a good chunk of illegal abortions were women just using home remedies, and that's where the majority of abortion injuries and deaths come from, in fact. So the notion that we don't ever have to talk about what happens to the women, well, the women are the ones performing the abortions in a majority, or in a solid chunk anyway, of the cases when abortion is illegal.
Do you think, turning to sort of this, I mean, sort of more, I guess, electorally, you know, like I listened to that Huckabee interview. And Huckabee now, look, I don't listen to Huckabee on a regular basis. In fact, I never listen to Huckabee. And maybe I'm missing out. So I don't know if this is already a part of his lexicon, but he kept talking about forcible rape. And, you know, I was aware that that Ryan and Aiken sponsored this bill about forcible rape. When stuff like this happens, you know, my first sense is like, okay, great. This is going to sort of like expose their greater agenda. But then I also have this concern of like, but now it sort of seems like forcible rape is now part of the lexicon. Like, you know, like from a rational policy sense, I got into it with Twitter with somebody. I don't know who it was. And, you know, they sort of had this like, well, the forcible rape is different between consensual sex. I mean, between statutory rape, blah, blah, blah. But there is no, I mean, like, the offensive thing is that from a policy standpoint, what difference does it make? And I think you've explained it, frankly, to me, is just that the, you know, which it's very hard to sort of accept, but if you get pregnant, you wanted the sex, so you weren't really raped. That's the way it works. That's the way God does it. God wouldn't make you pregnant unless you were, you know, unless the kid was extraordinary and God had a reason to have them because we needed another gospel singer or whatever it was. And, but are you concerned that like this idea of forcible rape now becomes part of the lexicon?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, even though I haven't seen anybody say it out loud, I think the implicit notion is that forcible rape is somehow different than, or it's being held in contrast linguistically with other concepts like date rape or acquaintance rape, which are, again, the majority of rapes. Those rapes are forcible by any legitimate, you know, understanding of what actually happens, but I think a lot of society doesn't understand that. We hear a term like acquaintance rape or date rape, and we somehow think it's a lesser rape or that it was less violent than, you know, the guy jumping out of the bushes and raping a stranger. You know, and the, to make it worse, most men who attack women that they know subdue their victims without beating them because that's how you go to jail. So they know better than to do that. But, you know, it doesn't mean that they didn't force them. They laid on top of them or they threatened them or they just basically implied that if they didn't go along with it, then the beating would come. And, you know, those rapes are basically being rewritten by the term forcible rape into not being rapes, even though the woman was forced to have sex against her will, just as much as if she'd been hit, you know?
And there's a reason why society calls it statutory rape. I mean, because the fact that there obviously is a forced dynamic there. I mean, that is, it seems to me definitionally, they're just attacking the concept of rape. And I, you know, like, I think we're just like literally months away from, you know, who's that dude on NBC News, Williams, just be like, you know, talking about so-and-so forcibly raped, you know, like that, you know, that was the sort of the most sort of creepiest thing about hearing that Huckabee thing is that now all of a sudden he's adopted this lexicon of forcible rape. I find that tremendously disturbing. And I just don't think, I mean, I think from an electoral standpoint, this could have sort of short-term benefits for Democrats in the House and the Senate. But I think, that they just seem to be continually pushing this notion. And because people try to address it in a rational, logic way, like, you know, we're seeing these stories in the New York Times, like, you know, it's actually, there is some controversy as to whether or not people get pregnant during rape. You know, these type of like, you know, honestly, there's a piece in the New York Times where it's, you know, let's hear from somebody from, you know, Dr. Johnson, who also happens to be with the Christian, you know, whatever. And he says it's, there's a lower incidence of pregnancy. I mean, first of all, it seems to me impossible to measure. By any, you know, even if we were able to collect the best amount of data possible, it seems impossible to measure. But the idea that you would entertain that conversation, because what's the value of that conversation from a policy standpoint? None.
Yeah. Well, I definitely agree. I mean, there have been measurements. It's estimated about 5% of rapes end up in pregnancy. But of course, those measurements are taken by interviewing women who say they've been raped. And if you don't think that women's own accounting of their experiences is legitimate, if you don't think that women are the best authority on their lives, then, yeah, there is no way to measure that. You can just call those women liars if you want to. And right. I think that's what they're exploiting is this notion that women's word is always considered, you know, iffy at best.
And the fact of the matter is we don't even know. I mean, do we really even know how many women are subjected to who are raped in this country? I mean, you know, I would imagine there's still a significant percentage of rapes that become unreported. I mean, it just seems to me that it's there's so many factors involved as the notion that that there is a statistical difference in someone's capacity to get pregnant from rape, it just seems to me to be unknowable. We can have, I mean, honestly, I mean, we can have a general notion, which seems to be generally at the same rate that that people get pregnant from consensual sex. I mean, so there, I don't know. I mean, it just the idea that there is a concerted effort to debunk this theory is almost as damaging as espousing the theory.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't even thought about it that from that point of view.
Well, I'm glad I could.
Sorry.
I mean, I just it seems to me like you know, like we we were talking about this yesterday in the office, and we were just like, this is ridiculous. I'm like, it doesn't matter. Like, there's absolutely, like, there's no way that we can really know this in any meaningful way that we can really know this, because there's so many factors as to why someone gets pregnant just in the context of even consensual sex. It's just virtually impossible to know, and there's no value in knowing it.
No value.
The debate itself has no policy implications unless, and this is what I think, you know, you've been very helpful in enlightening, unless you believe that God just doesn't make you pregnant if you've really been raped. And it's creepy. And we do not see, the New York Times is not going to write that. They're going to write the piece about, we have experts on both sides. And, you know, they tend to weigh against what this guy said. But it's reasonable conversation. As opposed to, this guy thinks it's all magic.
Yeah, it would be nice. And I mean, part of it, of course, is that we have this tendency to take people at their word. But I think that the problem is doing that with conservatives these days is that everything that they say is spoken through a layer of bad faith, misinformation, and lies. Like, how often do conservatives say what they actually think? How much of conservative talk is just trying to sort of spin what they mean in ways that sound a little less awful?
Right.
I think that's the
one ahead. Thing I think that, you know, Aiken should be complimented for. He came right out and he said it. And, you know, he lives in such a buzz of, what was it? I think Hayes called it a pessimistic closure or something like that. And epistemic, is that what it is? Forgive me.
Yeah, epistemic closure.
And this guy's just all of a sudden, it's like, you can get away with being in that bubble if you're a congressman, apparently, sitting on the science committee in the House. But apparently when you actually have to sort of like, you know, and, you know, I know that the guy apologized, the reporter, but like, I don't understand how you sit there and someone says that to you and you just go on to the next question. Like, that seems to me like, hey, this is a great time to do a follow-up on that.
Well, I will say, if I was that reporter, I would probably be like, well, how do I follow this up? Because there are like four things that he said that are questionable at best.
Right. I mean, he just went down to his notebook and said, okay, and then went on to like the next thing, like, what do you think about trade with you know, Korea, whatever. I mean, I don't know what he asked him, but it was like completely just like, oh, no, of course. No, I get that. Like, yeah, it has to be legitimate right before somebody gets pregnant. Okay. And next on the agenda is, I mean, I think it's just sort of like, you know, in that context, the guy seems sweet enough. Why not? But it's stunning, and I appreciate your, I mean, I really do think like the key, that people have to take away from this is just that the entire way that we conceive of reality is different from, these people because they're fundamentalists, and that, the outcome is a function of God, and God always does right. And so if someone gets pregnant, it's because God didn't give them a pass because they weren't truly raped.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Well,
that is exactly the logic there.
Amanda, I really appreciate it. Amanda Marcotte, Pentagon, Slate XX, and rhrealitycheck.org. We'll put links to that up on our site at majority.fm. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a... Well, you know what? We're not going to take a break. I'll do a couple more minutes, and then we'll wrap this puppy up. God would not have let me be sick if it wasn't for, if I hadn't. I must have obviously done something wrong. I don't know what it was I did, but. If I hadn't done something to offend God, he wouldn't have allowed my daughter to poison me with her virus. Just goes to show you that the female is always like, that's, I don't ever remember an occasion where I have given a cold to my daughter. Huh. I wonder why that is. It's obviously because we all know what happened with Adam and Eve and the apple and the snake, and so my daughter is trying to make me sick.
Women have full control of their body, Sam. She purposely knew what she was doing.
No, that's not true either, because God would not allow that. There's polling on the Aiken thing. I don't know. It seems too soon. Who cares? And, you know, I like I say, I think there's some value to the idea of exposing this. Some people think this is a bit of a sideshow. I would love this election to be about our economic policies. It's not going to, in some respects. I would love to see, and I've said this many times, I would love to see this to come down to Medicare so we can protect Medicare and Social Security. I hope that will happen. But I got to say, I mean, the more that we can sort of make this stuff toxic, the better. But I just don't think people understand. I mean, I found that talk with Amanda very enlightening. Because I went through for about an hour and a half yesterday, 2 hours on Twitter, with, I think she's a comedian. I don't know who it is. And we went back and forth on this, and I was, you know, trying to be civil, and I was like, what is this guy even trying to say? And she was the one who said, you know, the difference between statutory and not, and on and on. And I said, you know, like, and then she's trying to prove to me that there's some validity in what he's saying. And I said, look, you know, you can't send me a study about women under stress and how difficult it is for them to get pregnant, where the doctors think that it's like, well, they're so keyed on trying to get pregnant that they can't get pregnant. That you cannot extrapolate that that has anything to do with rape. And I'm like, that there's no way that we're ever going to answer this question if there's any type of tiny marginal difference. And then I was like, and what difference could it possibly make from a policy standpoint? And she wouldn't answer. She couldn't answer. And the only answer that makes sense is that God, if you are legitimately raped, God steps in and doesn't get you pregnant. Now, of course, this contravenes everything we know. We know that marauding armies through the years have used rape as a means of essentially breeding their enemies out of existence. In Judaism, originally it was paternal lineage, which provided one's Jewishness. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was changed to maternal because I think it was the Romans were basically trying to rape them out of existence. I'm sure it's happened I'm sure it's happened throughout history. But maybe God just was like, maybe that was God's plan. That's the advantage of that, incidentally. It's all God's plan. If it happens, of course, by definition, it's God's plan. If it doesn't happen, then it wasn't God's plan. How can I prove it was God's plan? It happened. Bingo. Speaking of God's plan, the AP, I think, won Pulitzer for its series on exposing the NYPD's Secret Intelligence Demographics Unit, where in conjunction with the CIA, remember, the CIA is not legally supposed to spy on domestically. I think the way they got around this is that they took a CIA agent, kept paying him from the CIA, and also had him paid at the new NYPD. Like, he had two jobs. It's like if, Matt, it's like you produce this show, and then you go and you do Citizen Radio. So you're not working for, you know, you're working for both of us. It's not. So, and we told you about the story of the super in New Jersey who stumbled upon a spying headquarters in New Jersey populated by the NYPD. We know that the NYPD went as far north as like Maine, upstate New York, down to, I think, North Carolina. They infiltrated Muslim college organizations. They spied on people.
They went overseas, too, I believe.
I think they went overseas. I mean, they went all over the place to spy on Muslims. In more than 6 years on spying Muslim neighborhoods, the New York Police Department's Secret Demographics Unit never generated a lead or triggered a terrorism investigation. That's according to court testimony unsealed Monday, August 20th, 2012. The Demographics Unit is at the heart of a police spying effort built with the help of the CIA. The unit created databases on where Muslims lived, shopped, worked, prayed. Police infiltrated Muslim student groups, put informants in mosques, monitored sermons, cataloged every Muslim in New York who adopted new Americanized surnames. Every Muslim who changed their name was cataloged. But Assistant Chief Thomas Galati said none of the conversations the officers overheard ever led to a case. Think about this. 6 years of cataloging every Muslim. And look, if you cataloged every Muslim who changed their name to an American name, you obviously, at least to some extent, cataloged every Muslim that you could get your hands on in the tri-state area. Plus, he described how police gather information on people even when there's no evidence of wrongdoing simply because of their ethnicity and native language. Businesses can be labeled, quote, a location of concern whenever police can expect to find groups of Middle Easterners there. This is so effed up, I can't even believe it. Galati testified as part of a lawsuit that began in 1971 over NYPD spying on student civil rights groups and suspected communist sympathizers. The lawsuit was known as the Handshoe Case. It resulted in federal guidelines that prohibited the NYPD from collecting information about political speech unless it's related to potential terrorism. And in this case, it's not even collecting information on political speech. It's collecting insurance based upon the brownness of your skin. Civil rights lawyers believe the demographics unit violated those rules. Do you think? Galati said the police were allowed to collect information because men spoke Urdu. That supposedly was a tip-off that they might be terrorists. I'm seeing Urdu. I'm seeing them identify the individuals involved that are Pakistani, Galati explained. Not that I know whether or not he sounded like that. There are 15 million Pakistanis and 60 million Indians who speak Urdu in the world. It's one of the national languages of Pakistan. But hey, if you speak an Urdu, we catalog them. Now it is known as the Zone Assessment Unit because it's just not appropriate to say, we're spying on brown people. Hey, but give us a break. At least we started spying on the white kids from Occupy. So we're spreading it all around. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. All right, let me take a couple IMs, and then we'll get out of here. Hi, Sam, from I'm Happy Now. Feel better. Kids are germ factories. They don't have to tell you before you decide to have them. I attempted to register to vote online today in Reno. New county just moved after 45 minutes online. Numerous attempts. I was unable. I made 3 phone calls to find out where I could go. One place in my county. I finally got the federal website to print out my form. What an effing hassle to not set up for websites to work on Macs. Go figure. Calhoun John, the problem with Aiken's thing is this whole whack jobs conservatives make up half the population in Missouri, and they agree with him. Bartleby, Sam, my advice for a cold, steady diet of acetaminophen and fluids. Also, just so you know, all throughout the interview with Ari, the audio stream was cutting in and out numerous times. You're the only person who told us that. Bush and Chains, I can't read this whole thing, buddy. I just don't have the energy. Represent Todd Aiken, Maine, by legitimate raid is what Obama, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs do to 330 million Americans every day to avert system collapse. Dude, that's like the Andy Borowitz school of comedy. I take one from this column, I take one from that column. Come on, you can do better than that. I get those tons more, but you're sick. Kaiser Zose, Sammy, listening today was important but gave me a panic attack about this voter suppression effort by the GOP. Great information, but I think it's too late for the states to catch up. This is a debacle. Sagita, Representative Steve Kings, never heard of a rape-induced pregnancy. There you go. God would never allow it. What picture? Sam, I've been Wellington, New Zealand now for the last 2 months doing VFX at Weta Digital. After observing the local politics, I have to wonder how America has gone so far from any resemblance to a reasonable discourse in our politics. It's obviously the heightened role that money plays in U.S. politics, but another huge difference seems to be purely cultural. You've spent time in Australia. Can you talk about how the U.S. has ended up in this totally bizarre political universe? I got a lot of thoughts on that. I cannot in any way do it today. You're going to have to ask me tomorrow what pictures, because I'm just too fried. Shanksoft, I'm sorry, but I can't continue my membership. The other hosts are childless and will produce content in a far more stable manner. The Vitocrat. Feel better, Sam. Thanks for another great show. And the final IM of the day, Kaiser Zose, where is Jeff Smith? Where is Jeff Smith? He's around. Contact him and see what's going on. Hey, if anybody knows anybody who's going down to the protest at the GOP convention or the Democratic convention, have them email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Love to get some correspondence. All right, folks. Tomorrow, I don't know if we're going to have a show. Probably not. I've got to deal with this cold. We need to do some tech stuff. So we'll be back Thursday. Until then, so long.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. We'll be right back. and pride.